Why does the United States rely on extremist Islamic militant groups as a means of furthering goals of imperialist domination? Why does it seem as if Western war planners have a preference for extremist Islam as opposed to other ideologies as they plot destabilization campaigns throughout the Middle East, Eurasia, and North Africa? What is behind one particular Islamist faction, Boko Haram, in northern Nigeria, and their kidnapping last month of over 200 schoolgirls from Chibok? Is the world being manipulated into supporting a military intervention that could be more destructive to girls and other vulnerable people in Nigeria? What is the geostrategic significance of Nigeria to the US and other Western powers, and what role does the country play in Africa? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we'll address these questions to award-winning geopolitical analyst and author Madi Darius Nazamroya, and to the editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikwe. On today's program, Agents of Empire, Fostering Extremist Islam in Nigeria and Beyond. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 16th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Voice of Russia reports, citing Russian press sources, that the country's Ministry of Finance is ready to greenlight a plan to radically increase the role of the Russian ruble in export operations while reducing the share of dollar-denominated transactions. Governmental sources believe that the Russian banking sector is, quote, ready to handle the increased number of ruble-denominated transactions, unquote. According to the Prime News Agency, on April 24th, the government organized a special meeting dedicated to finding a solution for getting rid of the U.S. dollar in Russian export operations. But more importantly, none of what Russia is contemplating would have any practical chance of implementation if it weren't for other nations who would engage in U.S. dollar-free bilateral trade relations. Such countries, however, do exist, and it should come as a surprise to nobody that the two which have already stepped up are none other than China and Iran. That's from the article, Russia Holds De-Dollarization Meeting, China, Iran Willing to Drop U.S. Dollar from Bilateral Trade, by Tyler Durden, posted May 14th, originally appearing at ZeroHedge.com. A platoon of approximately 30 armed undercover agents fired numerous rounds at the football crowds who were known to be pro-unity or pro-Ukraine and aligned with the Maidan coup government. The undercover gunmen started a street battle from behind police lines, hiding behind a wall of officers and instigating the football crowd to attack them. The neo-Nazi right sector joined the enraged football crowd, and together they pursued these provocateurs, who were dressed similarly to pro-Russian protesters, pursuing them all the way back to the Union Hall, where the actual non-violent anti-Maidan activists had set up camp. Once this violence had begun, it was easily turned against the real anti-Maidan activists, and the police provocateurs disappeared back into the police brigades. Further confirmation comes from a Ukrainian official, Acting Prosecutor General Oleh Makhnitsky, who said, quote, "This action in Odessa was not prepared at some internal level. It was a well-planned and coordinated action in which some authorities' representatives have taken part," unquote. As from the article, The Odessa massacre was a carefully staged covert intelligence operation by Joe Jambroni, posted May 14th, originally appearing at joejambroni.wordpress.com. Having masterminded the coup in February against the democratically elected government in Kiev, Washington's planned seizure of Russia's historic, legitimate warm water naval base in Crimea failed. But NATO's military encirclement has accelerated, along with U.S. orchestrated attacks on ethnic Russians in Ukraine. If Putin can be provoked into coming to their aid, his preordained pariah role will justify a NATO-run guerrilla war that is likely to spill into Russia itself. When Putin announced the withdrawal of Russian troops from the border, the Kiev junta's defense secretary, a founding member of the fascist Svoboda Party, boasted that the attacks on insurgents would continue. In Orwellian style, propaganda in the West has inverted this to Moscow, quote, trying to orchestrate conflict and provocation, unquote, according to William Hague. That's from the article Break the Silence, A World War is Beckoning, by John Pilger, posted May 14th, originally appearing at www.johnpilger.com. Five giant corporations control 90% of U.S. mass media. It is notable and should be emphasized that all the five major media conglomerates are corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations. This organization is a U.S. think tank whose members have been instrumental in formulating U.S. government policies, resulting in sanctions, destabilization efforts, and outright military attacks on nations which have never attacked the U.S. The Council's members' activities helped to promote the Iraq War, the bombings of Syria and Libya, and the recent overthrow of the elected government of the Ukraine. The promotion of these policies by the media conglomerates which belonged to the Council has been key to preparing the American public to accept these policies. That's from the article, How Five American Companies Control What You Think, by Eric Summer, posted May 15th, originally appearing on RT Op Edge. Return to the drone attacks at weddings, funerals, or just hanging out with friends. How do you think survivors of U.S. drone blasts respond to seeing their lives literally shattered and destroyed? Needlessly losing your loved ones, compliments of U.S. empire terrorism is a very bitter pill to have to swallow. Becoming easy to hate America as your eternal enemy, the human response is to want to get even, seeking revenge and avenging the tragic deaths of those you loved. And in this sinister way, the U.S. government guarantees a fresh supply of enemies in its permanent war on terror. Committing crimes against humanity as an effective means of bleeding U.S. taxpayers dry while waging multiple secret dirty wars around the world keeps the oligarch war profiteers happy. That's from the article, U.S. Terrorism from the Skies, The Truth Behind Drone Strikes as the President's Personal Choice of Warfare, by Joachim Hagopian, posted May 14th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The group Boko Haram has entered the public consciousness over the course of the last several weeks. It designates a group which has been active in northern Nigeria, northern Cameroon, southern Niger, and Chad. Founded in 2002 by Mohamed Yusuf, the group's stated aim is to establish an Islamic state ruled by Sharia law. The group has launched attacks on churches, mosques, schools, and police stations. In April, Boko Haram sparked international outrage when they kidnapped over 200 schoolgirls in the Nigerian community of Chibok. Activists in the West, many of them undoubtedly well-intentioned, are now pressuring U.S. military forces to intervene militarily in the name of protecting human rights. Is Boko Haram clandestinely supported by the U.S.? If so, it would join the ranks of the Mujahideen, the Kosovo Liberation Army, Al-Qaeda, and other Islamist brigades that were fostered and manipulated into advancing the goals of U.S. and other Western imperialist interests. Before focusing more closely on the specific example of Nigeria, we'll take a close look at the dynamics of these foreign-fostered Islamist militias with noted writer and researcher Mahdi Darius Nazimroya. Joining us once again is Mahdi Darius Nazimroya. He is an award-winning author and geopolitical analyst, the author of The Globalization of NATO and of the forthcoming book The War on Libya and the Recolonization of Africa. He's also a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization. Mahdi, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Thank you for having me.
Mahdi, I'd like to discuss with you the role of so-called Islamic extremist groups in carrying out Western geostrategy. Mahdi, why does it seem as if it seems to be the strategy of choice in the current world? Because we can look across Eurasia from, you know, up in Chechnya, the former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, North Africa, Syria, and we seem to see this repetition of the same model, the same formula of these groups that seem to go in and destabilize a territory or a government for the benefit of imperial powers. Why does it seem that that Islam appears to be favorable among the powers that implement that strategy?
Okay, well, I think that, first of all, all these areas you described are partially or predominantly inhabited by Muslims. So you are going to find any deviant organization that is formed there is going to be tied to that, or to some type of identity that's based in these lands we're talking about, whether it's Chechnya, whether it's Algeria, Libya, Mali, Somalia, Syria, Bosnia, Kosovo. You're going to have, you will have something that has to be tied to the identity of the land if it's going to be presented as something that's from there. You're not going to find in Chechnya you're not going to find in Chechnya like a U.S. sponsored, CIA sponsored Salvador option. You're not going to find a Colombian militia in Chechnya. You're not going to find in Somalia U.S. supported let's say IRA, Irish Republican Army, IRA. You're not going to find something that's not tied to the identities of these places. The other thing is that these areas you described, going from the Caucasus to North Africa to the Balkans, are all intense areas of rivalry in an area that the United States sees as a geopolitical pivot, sees central to an agenda, an objective of dominating the globe, these areas with resources. If the populations in these areas were primarily and predominantly Buddhist, you would see, I would venture to say, you're going to see Buddhist deviant organizations. You know, you're not going to see you're not going to see a group like Al-Qaeda form. You're going to see some sort of group that's tied to a Buddhist identity form. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that Muslim faith as an identity is a very strong force in these areas. So, and it's also a transnational force. So, those are things that the United States and its allies have capitalized on. They've capitalized on geopolitical views that all the Muslim countries should be united. So I guess the reemergence or reestablishment of a caliphate in these areas has been something they've played on. Differentiation between the Muslims in the peripheries of these areas and the non-Muslims, such as Christians, has been something that's been played upon. So in the Balkans, where You have I don't like using the word Muslim world because I don't see a Muslim or Christian world. I just see one world, and those are socially constructed terms. But where you see places such as this so-called Muslim world and the Orthodox Christian world, as well as the so-called Western Christian world. When I mean Western Christians, I mean Catholics and Protestants. When you see in the Balkans, they all intersect there. You're going to see Muslims being differentiated or used against Christian groups. You know, so you'd see them, the Bosniaks, for example, turned against Serbs and Croats. In the Caucasus, you would see Muslims turned against Christians. And by that I mean the Chechens, the Dagestanis against the Russians, who are predominantly Orthodox Christians. So, or in Sudan, you would see the Muslim North turned against you would see them turned against the southern populations. So differentiation is another aspect of that.
It seems as if. When you have if you want to resist an imperial giant, you can have some sort of in a secular framework where you've got a national identity, then the desired goal from the imperialist perspective is to sort of shake that up with other higher transcendent concepts like religion. And if you come, you put forward a distortion, or I guess your term was a deviant form of that religion, which reaches people on a deeper level, that can help mobilize people on a mass level. Am I kind of get? Is that kind of the way this works?
Well, it is, but I wouldn't exclude nationalism from that. I mean. Nationalism has also been used in these terms. Mm-hmm. We can look at the original Arab Spring, which was the great Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire. You know, they used the U.S. and the British used and supported Arab nationalism to break up the Ottoman Empire. You know, what was remaining of the Ottoman Empire. That's how Hejaz, which is the western coast of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq. That's how they broke up from the Ottoman Empire, is because of this. So national identities are no exception to this. But there is a nexus between religious identity and national identity. In fact, religious identity is probably the older of the two, and national identities are they're newer constructs compared to religious identities. Places like the Ottoman Empire and the former Tsarist Empire in Russia, people identified themselves on the basis of religion or town before. There was no national identity, or sometimes language. So that can also be used, national identity, for as well as ethnic identities, which are also we can throw into the mix. It can also be used and deviated and weaponized. That's what it comes down to. What is a denominator in speaking about religion, nationality, ethnicity, is tribalism here. And I don't mean tribalism in the sense of the classical tribe that people belong to. I mean tribalism in a derogatory way, and in a technical way, speaking about people believing that their tribe is the best, that, the rules can be bent for their tribe. And the key word in this would be exceptionalism. National identities, not just national identities, identities are a very important part of people's lives. They're a driving force, and they can easily be manipulated and weaponized anywhere in the world where one identity is set against another, whether it's a Shiite versus a Sunni, or a Serb versus a Croat, a Muslim versus a Christian, another region versus another region. It has many forms. So tribalism here is the denominator.
Hmm. Now, we're talking about Islam. You called it the deviant Islam, as the way you describe it. It seems that the reaches from North Africa, Middle East, right up into the Caucasus and Chechnya there, throughout the former Yugoslavia. Is there sort of a central core area where these operations or the training and the organizing is taking place, or is it fairly disparate?
No, there is a central area, and that goes back to what I originally mentioned is this is these type of organizations. Are violent organizations are popping up in areas where there's intense imperialist focus by the United States. So if it's a Caribbean island with Muslims, and there are Caribbean islands with Muslims, such as Trinidad and Tobago, you're not going to have these type of events. But if it's a place like the Caucasus, the United States is heavily interested in, and I can recall 2008, George W. Bush Jr., the head of the George Bush II administration, President of the United States, said that the Caucasus is an area of strategic importance to the United States when the war between the Republic of Georgia and the Russian Federation broke out. And the United States is heavily interested in the hydrocarbon reserves of the Caspian Sea, in the strategic location of the Caucasus. It wants to court the Republic of Azerbaijan, which is the neighbor of Iran and Russia, into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, as well as into the Euro-Atlantic zone or the transatlantic orbit. So these areas, including the Horn of Africa, which is strategically very important, the area around Senegal, Niger, Mali in West Africa, which there's off the coast, there's a lot of hydrocarbon reserves inside, inland, in the Sahel, and even in towards the Sahara, inner Sahara, the interior region. There's also a lot of resources. It's more than just a story about resources here. But the United States and its allies are heavily focused on these areas, and that's why you have these organizations. This is one of the reasons, one of the variables involved in these organizations forming, because they give a pretext, number one, for foreign intervention of any form. It could be military aid, basing rights. They exist to destabilize maybe competing economies or independent economies, such as Libya in the Gaddafi era. That's why these organizations are popping up there. So that's the denominator. The denominator is areas of focus by imperialism. And the other thing is, most of these areas fell under part of the colonial era, part of some sort of empire. So they're what used to be called the Third World, now the developing world. Developing world is not a term that I like. I don't agree with it. I think it's very ethnocentrically set. But that's what the common denominator is. It's on areas that are being competed over and focused on for imperialist control.
Mm. So we've identified the United States as one of the sponsors of these sorts of organizations. Do you see evidence that competitors, say China or Russia, are employing a similar kind of approach?
The Russians and the Chinese, it would destabilize them because their countries are proportionally divided in the sense that they have large Muslim populations. China has a larger Muslim population than many countries that are Muslim. You know, there's more Muslims in China than there are in Saudi Arabia, or more Muslims in China than there are in Albania. But anyways, my point is that they see this as a threat. In fact, though, one of the unifying factors for both the Chinese and the Russians, and one of the reasons for the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is an intergovernmental security, economic, political alliance between China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. One of the reasons this was formed is because the Chinese and the Russians, as well as these countries, wanted to fight the three evils. These three evils are isms, I-S-M-S. These three isms are terrorism, separatism, and extremism. So they don't want to use a Muslim card or to stoke the flames of spreading deviant groups. It's not to their benefit. It's to the national security threat for them, in the sense that it divides their countries. They've been victims of it, and they've always looked at the United States as a source for this. Whether it's the Russians in the Caucasus, not just Chechnya, there's other places like Dagestan, there's the around Sochi, there's even now, one of the latest incidents has been in the Volga, that's the northern part of the Caspian, which is not in the Caucasus. It is not to their favor to fan this, but that doesn't mean that they haven't used excuses of fighting these deviant groups to the benefit of security agendas that they have, which they've done. For example, the events in Chechnya allowed the Russian government to put some strict measures in the Caucasus to centralize power. I mean, they have been opportunistic about fighting these deviant groups, but they're not the source for the creation of them.
Okay. So as we look ahead, I mean, the population of the Western countries, as we saw with the Syria, it seems like the Western countries, U.S., U.K., France, there seems to be becoming quite war-weary. Does that imply increased reliance on these militant brigades to do the dirty work?
Well, one thing you can keep in mind is that I brought the fact that the smaller groups, the ones that are operating on focused operations are security contractors involved, and that also bridges into what's happening in modern warfare, and that's total privatization of modern warfare. You increasingly have more and more mercenary private security contractors taking over operations for the Pentagon or other military powers like the British or the French, because they're more reliable. They have ethics is not as much a question, and they're purely doing this for monetary reasons. I mean, the old concept of the armed forces was, of course, there's a monetary aspect tied to it. At some level, it depends which armed forces we're talking about. But it wasn't. It's not all done for that. There's defensive reasons. There's also the tie to national values, and of course, because of that type of structure, there's limitations. The Geneva Conventions, norms and values of why people join those armed forces is to serve and to protect their nation. Even if you don't agree with those ideas, that normative system is still tied to those. To entrance in these forces. So the candidates or the individuals who join these armed forces, they entrench these values. They internalize these values. But when you're talking about security contractors, I mean, they haven't joined their company or corporation to defend a nation. They haven't done it for anything but pure for profit. It's totally capitalist driven. That doesn't mean armed forces aren't used for capitalist agendas, but the security contractors are used for that. So you're seeing more and more of these Al-Qaeda type groups being used. They're far more efficient. They're outside of the rule of domestic laws. They can operate outside of international law. They do almost all the time. So there is a preference leaning towards these groups, and they're much more flexible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mahdi, I want to thank you very much for sharing that analysis with our listeners, and you'll look forward to having you back in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Mahdi Darius Nazem Roya, award-winning author and geopolitical analyst, and the author of The Globalization of NATO and the upcoming book, The War on Libya and the Recolonization of Africa. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The kidnapping of over 200 Nigerian schoolgirls from the community of Chibok has sparked outrage around the world, and media awareness of the group Boko Haram has intensified. Are there geostrategic and other factors in play that may be influencing a possible near-future military intervention by Western powers? Joining us to discuss this is Aboyomi Azikwe. He is editor of the Pan-African Newswire, which, as it states on its website, is the world's only international daily Pan-African news source. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, first of all, I know that you've been writing about Boko Haram for some time now, for, well, I guess since about 2009, a lot longer than a lot of the current hashtag warriors have been aware of them. What can you tell us about this group in particular? I know that, especially considering when we're hearing a lot about them being sort of militant Islamists, are there critical distinctions that need to be made between this group and, say, a group like Al Qaeda?
Yes, I think we have to look at the historical development of the West African state of Nigeria, which this year represents the centennial of the consolidation of British colonial rule in Nigeria. The Nigerian colonial system was based upon the divide and rule scenario, which the British developed during the 19th century. What happened with specific reference to Nigeria, it was largely divided into two and perhaps three different distinct regions. The north, which is heavily dominated by the Muslim population, and of course the south, which tends to be more Christian, and the west, which has both Christian and Muslims within the population. Most of the problems in the north stem from the failure of the colonial system to mold Nigeria into a cohesive nation state. Now, this had problems, developed problems during the 1960s, when in 1966 there were two military coup d'etats in the country. And then later on that year, there was the beginning of the massacre of the Igbos in the northern part of Nigeria, which led to a secessionist movement, the declaration of a state of Biafra, headed by the Biafran leader, Ojukwu, and then that led into a three-year civil war in which approximately 1 billion people died. So this problem did not begin 5 years ago with the storming of the headquarters of Boko Haram by the Nigerian police and the military. Now, the northern population groups tend to be less developed, but they tend to be more involved in the military apparatus of the state. In the south, there's a tremendous amount of underdevelopment, and that is a contradiction because most of the oil wealth generated in Nigeria comes from the southern regions of the country. So these are the contradictions that exist. You have a military that's heavily dominated by people in the north, and then you have a high concentration of oil, which is in the south. And then, of course, there's more drilling going on offshore in the Gulf of Guinea. And so all of this is, in fact, related to the U.S. military interests in Nigeria. The Boko Haram group, it was reported, even at its inception many years ago, that there were northern politicians as well as military officials who were providing support for the organization. The president at present, Goodluck Jonathan, is from the South. He comes from the Ijaw ethnic group. And they, of course, have been heavily disenfranchised as it relates to the oil industry. So there's an ongoing regional struggle that is taking place in Nigeria. And at the same time, Nigeria is a large producer of sweet crude oil. The United States is the largest country that imports oil from Nigeria. It's the largest on the African continent in regard to the export of oil into the United States. So the U.S. has its own strategic economic interests that's propelling it to get more involved militarily, not only in Nigeria, but in other parts of the African continent. So these are some of the variables, and it's within this context that we have to view the present struggle. Now, in 2009, the previous government in Nigeria staged a series of raids against the Boko Haram headquarters. The leader, Muhammad Yusuf, was killed extrajudiciously by the Nigerian police or the military. Their headquarters was destroyed, and they were pretty much forced underground at that point. And since that time period, they've been involved in what is considered asymmetric warfare. It's escalated, particularly since 2011, with the bombing of the United Nations headquarters in Nigeria. And the type of operations we see being carried out now by Boko Haram, or that are attributed to Boko Haram, has striking similarities to what we see being carried out by al-Qaeda in countries such as Iraq, for example. So there is a connection, but I don't know how firm the connection is ideologically, but apparently there is some type of military training and perhaps supply of military equipment by al-Qaeda elements or al-Qaeda-linked elements to Boko Haram, just based upon the type of military attacks that we've seen just over the last several weeks. For example, within the course of 3 weeks, there were two bombings in the political capital of Abuja that killed well over 80 people. And this is the same city in which the World Economic Forum on Africa was held just last week, where it was announced during that summit that the Pentagon, as well as other NATO forces, as well as the State of Israel, would get involved in providing additional security assistance to Nigeria, and also in the efforts to retrieve these high school girls who were kidnapped over a month ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did mention a bit about the reality of Nigeria as a former formerly colonized by the major powers, and that they have principally the Islamic presence in the north of the country, and the principally Christian presence in the south, and you also mentioning about the whole divide and conquer strategy. Are they principally tensions between Islamic and Christian elements here that are being sort of, I guess, deliberately fostered?
Yes. There's been that tension since the beginning of the independence of Nigeria in 1960, and it largely revolves around access to the state apparatus. The Igbo population, who are largely in the southeast, were heavily involved in the civil service. Many of them were also involved in the informal middle trading sector of the country. And there tended to be more educational facilities granted to the Igbo population, which created tensions during the 1960s. The first president of the country was Igbo. The first coup that was waged in 1966 was carried out by an Igbo officer, but of course it was reversed later by Gowon, who was from the north, who had a different view than the initial coup makers earlier in 1966. And then, of course, we have to deal with the access to the profits and revenues associated with the oil industry. And there's a lot of corruption that goes on in the oil and natural gas industry in Nigeria, which accounts for 95% of the foreign exchange earnings of the country. So access to these resources, of course, are largely the result of this internal tension that's going on inside of the country. So it's not just a question of Muslims don't like Christians or Christians don't like Muslims. It's a question of these various communities, these ethnic groups and these religious groups having access to the state, which is a means of facilitating access to the profits from the oil and natural gas industry. And I also need to point out that the Muslim groups in the north claim that they have no connection with Boko Haram and that they do not agree with the Boko Haram approach to the Islamic religion. And this is just not confined to Muslim groups in the north. This has been something that has been enunciated internationally, that many Muslim organizations, the Organization of Islamist Conference and others, have distanced themselves from Boko Haram, saying that they're really not practicing the religion of Islam, that they have other intentions and another agenda, which is totally unrelated to the traditional religious practices of the Islamic faith.
Now, could you explain, I mean, Nigeria has been identified recently as the richest economy in Africa. I'm kind of, where would Nigeria be situated with regard to other African countries? I mean, if you had to compare it to the Middle East region or South America, I mean, is it's a major regional power?
Yes and no. On the one hand, if you look at the Republic of South Africa, which had been considered to be the largest economy on the African continent, Nigeria ostensibly, according to these various financial publications, have exceeded the Republic of South Africa. As an independent observer, I have questions about the character of that analysis. What are the motivations behind it? It came at the same time as the hosting of the World Economic Forum on Africa, and also at the same time that you have these escalating security problems that are going on inside the country. So on the one hand, you hear these Western financial analysts saying there's unprecedented levels of growth that are taking place in Nigeria. But at the same time, other elements are saying that there's an extreme security crisis inside the country as well. So it may appear to be a contradictory narrative, but in many ways they flow together. Because if they can say that Nigeria has the largest economy on the African continent, and that at the same time, they have a security crisis inside the country that the national police and the national military cannot solve, then this, of course, provides a rationale for the Pentagon, the CIA, the British intelligence, NATO, and the State of Israel to intervene ostensibly on behalf of the Nigerian government and in partnership with the Nigerian government to battle the so-called terrorist threat as posed by Boko Haram, which they say is linked with Al-Qaeda. So I think it may appear to be a counter or a contradictory narrative, but in fact they flow together. And I believe Nigeria as a state is being set up by these Western imperialist powers to further their interests in the oil industry there, as well as the overall economic development that's taking place on the African continent, particularly in the Gulf of Guinea, which is a source of tremendous untapped oil resources in Africa.
What is your take on the apparent inability of the Nigerian military to contain Boko Haram under the current circumstances? Has that been a historical concern?
Well, first of all, many of the elements who have high-ranking positions within the military are from the North. And there's a resentment against the presidency of Goodluck Jonathan. And there are people who did not want him as president, and there are people who want him out in the upcoming elections in 2015. So it could be a situation where they are not pursuing Boko Haram aggressively in order to create a security crisis inside the country and providing a reason why President Johnson should not be reelected in 2015. Also, his own party, the People's Democratic Party of Nigeria, is fractured. There's been a major split inside the party. So his success in next year's election is a major question that is facing the Nigerian body politic. Also, we have to take into consideration the fact that now it is not as acceptable for the military to intervene in politics in Africa. I believe if the current situation that exists now had existed 20 or 30 years ago, that there would have been elements within the military who would have staged a coup d'etat against the Jonathan government because it is being exposed for its ineptitude and its inability to resolve the internal economic crisis, economic and security crisis inside the country. But now it would be more difficult for the army or elements within the army to stage a coup against Jonathan, although there are probably plans and plots underway to do so, and there's probably the political will to do so among elements within the military. But in terms of the international community, including the African Union, which now takes a harder line on military intervention in politics. So I believe that there are elements in the North who are tacitly backing Boko Haram and at the same time not pursuing aggressively their criminal activity inside the country. Now, Borno State, where Chibok is located, the village of Chibok, where the girls were abducted from, has been under a state of emergency now for several months. So you would think that the military and the police would have adequate forces to prevent such actions from taking place and also to aggressively and successfully pursue these people who are involved in the abductions. They're claiming that the these young women may be held in the Zambezi forest. If they know that much, then it would seem that they would be in a position to pursue them. Nigeria has a large military, and they could and have in the past conducted very effective and even ruthless military operations against opposition forces, criminal elements, and others. But at this point, it appears as if they are incapable of doing it, and I believe the incapacity of them to do it is related to the political divide that's going on in Nigeria.
Could you tell us a little bit about, I mean, I think many of our listeners are familiar with the entity, the African Command or AFRICOM. Are we seeing, you know, some mobilizations there on the side that seem to suggest they're, you know, preparing to pounce or mobilize in some capacity inside of the region?
Yes, the United States Africa Command was formed in 2008 under the presidency of George W. Bush, and it was very controversial when it started. They wanted to set up a base on the African continent, and even Nigeria under the previous government opposed that. South Africa opposed it. The African Union in general opposed it. However, even though they're still based in Stuttgart, Germany, there is a base in the Horn of Africa in the nation of Djibouti, which contains several thousand U.S. Troops there, and they have plans to expand the base at Camp Lemone in Djibouti. And but at the same time, they're involved in all these joint military operations on the ground as well as naval operations. There was just one completed in the Gulf of Guinea several weeks ago that involved the Pentagon as well as the European Union military forces, EUFOR. in cooperation with several African governments in the West African region. So there's already extensive cooperation between the United States Africa Command, AFRICOM, as well as the European military forces, EUFOR, as well as NATO, in dealing with various aspects of security concerns in West Africa and other parts of Africa as well. And we believe that this is a danger to the independence and sovereignty of the African continent, that there's nothing to be gained on the part of the African nation states as it relates to these partnerships, these joint maneuvers, both on land and offshore. And what we've seen over the last 6 years since the formation of the United States Africa Command is that the security situation in these various states where the United States has been heavily involved has not been enhanced. In fact, it has declined. Insecurity has worsened. For example, in Mali, AFRICOM had an extensive training program with the Malian government. They were training officers. They were, of course, supplying weapons and even monetary compensation for soldiers and officers within the Malian military. And what we saw in 2012 was that the leader of a military coup d'etat, Amadou Sonogo, had been trained by the United States Pentagon in the United States. He staged the coup, and when ostensibly because the civilian government was not capable of dealing with an insurgency in the north among the Tuareg population, his coup, in fact, worsened the security situation in the north of Mali, and therefore precipitating a French military intervention, which was supported by the United States in January of 2013. And we've seen the same situation in South Sudan, where the United States was more or less the handmaiden of the formation of the Republic of South Sudan. And it's an independent state now for almost 3 years, and it's on the verge of collapse, despite the fact that the United States was heavily involved in its creation, and they have an East Africa response force that is active in South Sudan. They also have special forces that are active in South Sudan, ostensibly hunting for another rebel leader, Joseph Kony, who is from Uganda, who they claim may be in South Sudan or in the Central African Republic. So these, and in Somalia is the same situation. They've been there for a number of years. The CIA has a field station in Somalia. They fund the African Union mission to Somalia, 22,000 strong military force inside the country. And they have not been able to stamp out the Al-Shabaab resistance organization there. And instability has crept as well into Kenya. We've seen numerous incidents in Kenya, ostensibly carried out by Al-Shabaab. So my point is that despite the fact that this increasing partnership between AFRICOM and the African Union member states are taking place, it has not enhanced the security capacity of the African states who are in cooperation with AFRICOM, but in fact, it has done just the opposite, that it has increased instability and therefore necessitating even greater Pentagon as well as NATO intervention in Africa.
So it's your contention then that if these powers, the United States, France, and I believe you mentioned Israel as well, were to quote-unquote respond to a world outrage to rescue these girls and stamp out Boko Haram, that it could actually make things, and not that that isn't a concern, but it could actually make things worse for the civilian population at large.
Oh, it will. I mean, if you look at any intervention that the United States and NATO has been involved in, it has brought about massive deaths and dislocation. All we have to do is look at Libya, which had the strongest economy on the African continent, had a huge income for gross domestic product. They had foreign reserves of over $160 billion. They had 2 to 4 million guest workers there. The country was investing in infrastructural and technological development in other African states. And since the Pentagon, the CIA, and NATO intervened in March of 2011, Libya has deteriorated. Libya has, in fact, become one of the greatest security threats on the African continent, not only for Africa, but also for Southern Europe as well. So to say, or even to suggest, that the intervention of the Pentagon, the CIA, and NATO will enhance security in Nigeria, the track record of these entities over the last several years say just the opposite.
Could you, I mean, you mentioned Libya, you mentioned Sudan a moment ago. I mean, there are different scenarios that are playing out in terms of the end game for a Western interventionist effort. I mean, but they seem to be different outcomes. I mean, Sudan got balkanized, essentially. Libya was, just replaced with a proxy regime. What do you see as taking place, the desired end game for Nigeria? Will it be balkanized? Will it be just a new regime that is more agreeable, or even the current regime that's just kind of being made to submit more to the current demands from outside powers? How do you say things playing out?
Well, yes, I think that they want to secure the oil and natural gas resources in Nigeria. They want to, at the same time, maintain the ability of the U.S. military forces and NATO forces to have a permanent presence in Nigeria. They also want to weaken the internal cohesiveness of the Nigerian state, because this, in fact, provides another impetus for military intervention on a more permanent basis. Also, they want to block the People's Republic of China from any deeper economic involvement in Nigeria. They had expressed several years ago the desire to invest well over $20 billion in building refineries and other technological instruments for the oil and natural gas industry in Nigeria. I think the United States is very concerned about that vis-a-vis Nigeria as well as other African states. So I think that it's a number of factors involved, and China, along with other states, Brazil and others, are interested in enhancing their economic relations with Nigeria. But it's going to be very difficult when you have the large-scale presence of the Pentagon and NATO forces, as well as this security threat that appears to be growing inside the country as well.
Well, Abayomi Azikwe, I want to thank you very much for sharing that very thorough analysis of the situation with our listeners. I hope you'll be agreeable to coming back on our show in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you so much for the invitation, and I really appreciate the work that Global Research is doing. It's enormous, and it's very helpful, not only for people in North America, but for people throughout the world.
Okay, thank you very much. Abayomi Azikwe is editor of Pan-African Newswire. You can check out that site is panafricannews.blogspot.com. And Abayomi Azikwe is also a frequent contributor to Global Research. That concludes our show. You've been listening to the Global Research NewsHour. You can hear our program every week on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across the country. The show can be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and can be downloaded from the website globalresearch.ca. Thank you for joining us. If you have any questions or comments about today's program, feel free to send your feedback to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Join us again next week.